As it was, given my past tendencies toward lying, breaking and entering, and petty theft, I made certain to frame my explanation with care. While I didn't imagine he suspected me of anything, I wanted to appear honest and artless. Not difficult, since in this one rare instance, what I had to offer was the truth. I'm not sure how to describe the process. I was up at Lloyd's. He's Crystal's ex-husband. Leela's stepdad. Right. This morning, she left boarding school without permission, and Crystal figured she was headed for his place. I told Crystal I'd see if I could track her down, so I began cruising the area there at Little Pony Road and the 101. She must have hitchhiked because I spotted her walking on the berm. I talked her into letting me drive her up to Lloyd's. He was gone when we got there, so she led us into the house. His is that A-frame, I said, and pointed to the far side of the lake. Under the weight of Paglia's gaze, my tone sounded false, and I found myself adding a few extraneous details. Well, it's actually not his. He's house-sitting for a friend who went to Florida. Anyway, I was just messing around while we waited for him to show. Leela was watching TV, and I went up to the loft. I saw the telescope and thought it'd be interesting to take a peek. I was surprised to see where I was. I hadn't realized that section of Gramercy put him directly across the reservoir from Fiona.
You think there's a connection?
Between Lloyd and Fiona? I don't know, but I doubt it. I've never heard anything to that effect. He took out an Altoids box. He opened the lid and deposited the dead butt. I could see he'd fill the bottom of the tin with ash, his way of avoiding contamination at the scene. He returned the box to his raincoat pocket, and his gray eyes met mine. I said, "Do you consider this a crime scene?"
"Suicide's a crime," he said. "Go on with your story."
His lower teeth were buckled together in the center and rimmed with stains. It was the only thing about him that seemed out of control. When I looked through the telescope, I saw the dog. This is a German shepherd named Trudy. I'd seen her up here on my two visits to Fiona's house, and she was always over in this area, barking her head off. Paglia said,
"Dogs can smell a body even underwater."
This was the first piece of information he'd offered me. Really? I didn't know that. I could see she was excited, but I had no idea why. Aside from Trudy, I could see some scarring on that boulder halfway up the slope. Again, I pointed like a fifth grader giving an oral report. There was also damage to the vegetation. Saplings snapped off. At first, I figured somebody must have backed a trailer down to launch a boat, but then I caught sight of the posted warning, and I remembered that swimming and boating were forbidden. He seemed to study me, his expression one of calculated kindness.
"I still don't understand how you made the connection."
The idea just suddenly made sense. Dr. Purcell was last seen at the clinic. I'd heard he was on his way up here to see Fiona, so I...
"Who told you that?"
"A friend of Purcell's. A fellow named Jacob Trigg. Dow told him he had a meeting scheduled with her that night."
"You talked to her about this?"
"Well, I asked her."
"Why not?"
"I was pissed. I work for her. She should have given me the information the moment I hired on."
"What'd she say?"
"She claims he didn't show. Called it a miscommunication. I assumed he stood her up and she was too embarrassed to admit it."
"Too bad she didn't mention it to us. We could have canvassed up here. Somebody might have heard the car. 9+ weeks later, who's going to remember?"
Behind him, I heard the high whine of the gear, the rumble as the cable was wound around the drum, dragging the Mercedes from the lake. Water gushed from the open windows, from the underside, from the wheel mounts. Nearby, the coroner's van was parked in the grass, its rear doors open. The coroner's assistant and a uniformed officer were removing a long metal trunk, which I recognized as the stainless steel tank in which a floater could be sealed. Paglia said,
"Ginzy?"
I turned my gaze back to his. I felt cold.
"The diver says there's someone in the front seat."
The Mercedes was now suspended in a forward tilt, front end down, three of the four windows opened. Lake water poured from every crack and crevice, draining through the floorboards, splashing onto ground already soaked by days of rain.
I watched, my responses suspended as the vehicle was hauled partway up the slope, gushing like a tank that had sprung a sudden leak. The window on the driver's side had been shattered, the bottom half still a maze of crazed glass, the upper portion gone. In the front seat, I caught a glimpse of a vaguely human shape, amorphous, all bloat and slime, face turned toward the window gap as if peeking at the view. After weeks in the water, the once living flesh was bloodless, bleached a pearly white. He still wore his suit coat, but that was all I could see of him from where I stood. I turned my head abruptly and made an involuntary sound. The glue holding his bones together had loosened and given way so that he seemed flaccid, indifferent, his eye sockets swimming with a pale gelatin. His mouth was open, his jaw relaxed. His lips had widened in a final expression of joy or surprise. A howl of rage, perhaps. "I'll be in the car," I said. Paglia didn't hear me. He was heading for the Mercedes. The morgue crew stood back. Peripherally, I saw flashes as the police photographer began to document her work. I couldn't watch any longer. I couldn't be in that place. These people were schooled in the sight of death, tutored by its odors, by its poses, by the peculiar posture of bodies caught in their final bow to life. Ordinarily, at such a scene, after the first jolt of revulsion, I can become detached. Here, I couldn't manage it. Couldn't shake off the feeling that I was in the presence of something evil. Purcell, assuming the body was his, had either killed himself or been killed. There was no way he could have driven up that hill and down into the lake by accident. Chapter 16. By the time I returned to my apartment, it was after 10 o'clock. The crime scene technicians were still busy at the reservoir, though I couldn't imagine what remained to be done. I'd hung around for a while and then decided to head home. I'd never eaten dinner. In fact, as nearly as I remembered, I hadn't eaten lunch. Hunger had asserted itself and then faded at least twice during the evening, and now had dissipated altogether, leaving a nagging headache in its wake. I was both wired and exhausted, a curious mix. Mercifully, the rain had moved on and the temperature had warmed. The street seemed to smoke, vapor rising in drifts. The sidewalks were still wet, water dripping from the tree limbs as silently as snow. The gutters gurgled merrily, miniature rivers diverted by debris as the runoff traveled downstream into sewers to the sea. A fog began to accumulate, making the world seem hushed and dense. My neighborhood looked unfamiliar, a landscape made alien by mist. Depths were flattened to two dimensions, bare branches no more than ink lines bleeding onto a page. My apartment was dark. I'd left home at 10 a.m., nearly 12 hours earlier, and it hadn't occurred to me to leave lights on for myself. I paused in the process of unlocking my door. Henry's kitchen window was aglow, a small square of yellow in the hovering mist. I tucked the keys in my pocket and crossed the flagstone patio. I peered into the upper portion of his back door. He was seated at the table, which was littered with paperwork, stacks of medical statements, canceled checks and receipts, all sorted into piles. He was wearing his bathrobe, a ratty blue flannel number with blue and white striped pajamas visible under it, cuffs drooping over his battered leather slippers. On the floor near his feet, he placed a wastebasket and the brown accordion file he was using to organize Clotilda's bills. The grocery bag of bills Rosie'd given him was sitting on a chair and still appeared to be half full. As I looked on, he ran a hand through his hair, leaving strands sticking out in three directions. He reached for a glass of his Jack Daniels and took a swallow, then frowned when he realized the ice had long since melted. He got up and moved to the sink where he tossed the watery contents. I called, "Henry?" and then tapped on the glass. He looked over, unperturbed by the interruption, and gestured for me to enter. I tried the knob and pointed. "Door's locked." Henry let me in. While I doffed my slicker and hung it over the back of the chair, he opened the freezer door and removed a handful of ice cubes, which he plunked in his glass, pouring a fresh round of whiskey over them. I picked up the scent of his afternoon baking, something with cinnamon, almond extract, butter, and yeast. The litter on the table looked even worse at close range. This is cute. How's it coming? I'm almost afraid to ask. Terrible. Just awful. The codes are gibberish. I can't figure out who owes what or which of these is paid. I had them sorted by date, but that turned out to be pointless. Now I'm filing them by doctor, hospital, and procedure, and I seem to be getting somewhere. I don't know how people ever make sense of these things. It's ridiculous. I told you not to do it. I know. But I said I'd help, and I hate to go back on my word. Oh, quit being such a wuss and give the damn things back to her. What's she going to do with them? She'll figure it out, or she can have William do it. Clotilda was his sister-in-law. Why should you get stuck? I feel sorry for her. Clotilda was her only sister, and it's bound to be tough. She didn't even like Clotilda. They barely spoke to each other, and when they did, they fought. Don't be so hard on her. Rosie has a good heart, he said. Having bitched, he now felt guilty for complaining behind her back. I could see that arguing with the man was only going to make things worse. Mentally, I rolled my eyes. I'll let you off the hook temporarily, but I won't give up. Henry took a seat at the table. So, what's up with you? You look beat. I am. I lifted a stack of medical statements from the seat of the chair and stood there, puzzled about what to do with them. Henry jumped up. Here, let me take care of those. He handed me his drink while he shoved the papers to one side and cleared a space at the table. He scooped up the grocery bag and the accordion file and put both on the floor, then took the papers from my hand and put them on the floor as well. I said, thanks, and took a swallow of Jack Daniels, which flamed through my system like a sudden case of heartburn. I could feel my tension ease and realize belatedly how very tired I was. My head had begun to pound in a rhythm with my pulse. Ka-thong, ka-thong. I passed the glass back to him and sank into the chair he'd just cleared. What's going on? We found Dr. Purcell's car and his body, assuming it's him. I can't really talk about it yet. Give me a few minutes to collect myself. Can I fix you a drink? Don't think so. But if you have any Tylenol, I could use about 40, preferably extra strength. I have something better. You just stay where you are. No problem. I'm incapable of moving. I'll fill you in momentarily unless I pass out first. I crossed my arms on the table in front of me and laid my head down, feeling my body go limp. This was the pre-nap posture we adopted in kindergarten, and it still represents the ultimate in personal relief. At the age of 5, I learned to drop into a deep sleep the minute my head hit my arms. I'd wake 10 minutes later, the nerve endings in my fingers all sparkly for lack of circulation, my cheek hot with dreams. I heard Henry cross to the refrigerator and transfer containers to the counter. I listened to the restful clink of jars and cutlery. It was like being in a sick bed, hearing homely sounds emanating from a nearby room. I must have dozed for a moment, the same fleeting lapse of awareness that'll send you careening off the highway when it happens at the wheel. Sound faded and returned, a brief slip into unconsciousness. What are you doing? I murmured without lifting my head. Making you a sandwich. His voice seemed to come from very far away. Roast beef with red onion that I've sliced paper thin. I propped my head on one fist and watched him place two thick slices of homemade bread side by side. He spread them liberally with mayonnaise, spicy brown mustard, and horseradish. This is virulent, but you need something fierce. Pep you up. He cut the sandwich in half and laid it on a plate with a sprig of parsley, pickles, olives, and pepperoncini clustered to one side. He set the plate in front of me and returned to the refrigerator, where he opened the freezer and removed a beer mug so cold that a white frost formed instantly on the glass when it hit the air. He opened a bottle of beer, poured it gently down the side of the mug to avoid the foam. He picked up his whiskey glass and sat down across from me. I took a bite of the sandwich. The horseradish was so ferocious it brought tears to my eyes. Pungent fumes licked through my sinuses, making my nose run as well. This is great! I can't believe how good it is. You're a genius. I paused, using my paper napkin as a nostril mop. The roast beef was succulent, its chill tenderness the perfect foil to the heat, salt, and sour of the condiments. Now and then I'd suck down a mouthful of cold beer, all tingle and bubbles, tasting of hops. Life was reduced to its four basic elements: air, food, drink, and a good friend. I shoved in the last bite of sandwich, licked the mustard from my fingers, and moaned in gratitude. I took a long, slow breath, noting the fact that my headache was gone. Better. I thought that might help. Now, tell me about the doctor. I gave Henry a summary of events leading up to my discovery. He knows how my mind works, so I didn't have to fill in all the nitty-gritty details. Most intuition is the sudden leap the mind makes when two elements fuse. Sometimes the connection is made through trial and error. Sometimes the underlying question butts up against observation, and the answer pops into view. I didn't spot the car so much as I spotted the traces it left in its journey down the hill. So that is the end of that job. I'm assuming as much, though I haven't spoken with Fiona. What now? The usual. Dr. Yi will do the autopsy in the morning. Don't know how much they'll learn, given the shape the body's in. The vehicle's probably been submerged since the night he dropped from view. As soon as the post is done, I'm guessing they'll cremate the remains. I'm sorry to hear this. It's too bad. It has to be worse when the questions are unresolved. At least now his family knows and they can get on with life. We chatted on in this vein, exploring our reactions and speculations, until the subject petered out. Henry picked up my plate and took it to the sink. I can do that, I said. Stay where you are. He ran hot water in the sink and picked up a dish sponge with liquid detergent in the handle. He soaped the plate, rinsed it, and set it in the rack. By the way, I saw a friend of yours tonight. Really? Who? He put the cutting board in the sink and began to put the condiments away. Tommy Heavener came into Rosie's. He was looking for you, of course, but we ended up having quite a chat. He seems like a nice fellow, and he's clearly smitten. He asked a lot of questions about you. I have a lot of questions about him, too. That's the part of my day I haven't told you about yet. He paused with his hand on the refrigerator door. I don't like the tone of this. You won't like the rest of it either. I waited until he returned to the table and took a seat. He said, What? With apprehension, like he really didn't want to hear. Turns out Tommy Heavener and his brother hired a punk down in Texas to break into the family home and steal the valuables, including close to $1 million in jewels. The burglar did as instructed and then set fire to the house to cover his tracks. What the boys failed to mention to him was that Mom and Dad were stashed in the closet, bound and gagged. They died of smoke inhalation while the place burned down around them. Henry blinked. No. Yes. But that can't be true. It is, I said. The insurance investigator, this is a woman named Mariah Talbot, came to the office this morning and showed me the clippings from the Hatchet Daily News Gazette, or whatever the hell it's called. I left the file at the office, or you could see for yourself. But if that's the case, why aren't they in jail? There was never enough evidence, and since the boys were never charged, they managed to collect on the fire loss, life insurance, and the inheritance. All told, they walked off with a couple $1 million. Their aunt and the insurance company are preparing a civil suit, hoping to recover whatever assets remain. But how do they know the burglar wasn't the one responsible? He might have surprised the parents, thinking they were gone when he broke into the house. Maybe he was the one who tied them up and gagged them. Unfortunately, the burglar hasn't been heard from since. Speculation has it they killed him, too. But they can't be sure, he said. That's why they've reopened the investigation.
Recently, an informant stepped forward and Guardian Casualty is prepared to go forward on the basis of this new information.
I can't believe it.
I had the same reaction until I saw the articles. I mean, here's what gets me. The first time I met Tommy, he told me his parents died in an accident. He didn't want me to mention it to Richard because he said his brother was still touchy about the subject. I thought, well, those poor dear fellows, here I am thinking about my parents and feeling sorry for these guys. It really galls me to think how easily I got sucked in. Such bullshit. According to the paper, they even offered a big reward, $100,000, for information leading to the arrest and conviction of the killer or killers of Jared and Brenda Heavener. Why not offer millions? They're in no danger of paying unless one rats the other out. How can you do business with them? That's what I'm getting to. I signed a year's lease and paid 6 months in advance, plus a cleaning deposit. We don't want to forget that little item. Now I can't figure out how to get out of it. I'm willing to forfeit the money, but it pisses me off. Let Lonnie handle it. He'll know what to do. Good thought, I said. Not that it ends there. Why not? Mariah thinks the jewelry's still somewhere in that big fancy house of theirs. She's hoping I can locate the safe so the cops can get a search warrant. She says the Heaveners' funds are just about depleted. They've been traveling in the fast lane, and now they're close to broke. She's hoping they'll try to sell at least a portion of the jewelry. Since they filed a claim for the loss, and since they've steadfastly denied any knowledge of the stash, it's not going to look good. If she can get them to tip their hand, the cops will step in with a warrant for their arrest. Why would they risk selling? They're not dumb. Not so far, but they're getting desperate. How's she going to persuade them? I can't imagine such a thing. Ah, she's not. She wants me to do it. I fished the piece of paper from my handbag. She gave me the name of a fence in Los Angeles and asked me to pass the information on to them. Henry took the scrap of paper on which he'd written the jeweler's name. Sarah Lambrow's a pawnbroker? A jeweler. She says he runs a legitimate business, as far as it goes. He also deals in stolen property when the goods warrant it. In this case, no sweat. She showed me the Polaroids. Rings, bracelets, necklaces. Gorgeous. Really beautiful. Why can't she give them the information? Because they know who she is and they'd never fall for it. But why you? Henry's tone was becoming belligerent and I could feel my face heat. Because Tommy's interested in me. So what? Mariah's shrewd. She ran a background on me and she knows I'm not above bending the rules. Aren't you talking about entrapment? Why would it be entrapment? I mentioned a guy who buys jewelry. If they're not guilty, they won't have anything to sell. Entrapments, where the cops entice someone to break the law. I'm not encouraging them to steal. They've already done that. But they're going to smell a rat. You mention a jeweler. They pawn the stuff, and shortly afterwards they're arrested and thrown in jail? You can't be serious. By then it's too late. They're already behind bars. Suppose they post bail. The minute they hit the street, they're going to come looking for you. Come on, Henry, give me credit here. I won't come right out and say, gee, anybody have any stolen jewels to lay off on this guy? I'll think of a story to tell, something plausible. Such as what? I don't know. I haven't made that part up yet. Exasperated, Henry leaned back in his chair and stared at me. How many times have we had a conversation like this? You come up with some stupid scheme. I urge you not to do it, but you go right ahead and do it. You always find some way to rationalize your behavior. So does everyone else. More's the pity, he said. I'll tell you this once, and then I swear I won't mention it again. Don't do this. Don't get involved. It's none of your business. I didn't say I would. How are you going to find the safe? You'll have to get into the house. Tommy's taken me up there once. All I have to do is talk him into taking me again. Which he'd do in hopes of getting in your pants. I can handle that. But why take the risk? I don't think you should be alone with either one of them.
Not to make light of it, but I've done a lot worse with a lot less justification.
I'll say. Henry, I promise you I won't act in haste. I haven't even figured out what I'll say. You know, assuming I decide to take the job. Why do this to yourself? Surely you don't need the money. Money isn't the issue here. I just don't think people should get away with murder. It isn't up to you. If the police had had sufficient evidence, the Heaveners would have been arrested and convicted back then. There wasn't any proof. That's the way the law works. You stay out of it. Please. You know what? I'm tempted to do this for exactly the same reason you're tempted to help Rosie. Because you can't resist. So here's the deal. You want me to butt out of this? You butt out of Rosie's business and we'll call it a wash. It's not illegal or dangerous to help an old lady pay her sister's medical bills. He had a point, but I refuse to acknowledge it. Skip it. Enough. Let's quit arguing. You take care of your life and I'll take care of mine. You're right. It's not my concern. Do anything you want. Don't play injured. It's not that. I think you worry too much. And you don't worry enough. It was 11:03 when I left Henry's place and headed to my apartment. We'd made a superficial effort to patch up our differences, but nothing had been resolved. I was feeling anxious and out of sorts, and so I suspect was he. I let myself in and set my bag aside. I turned on the television set and turned to KEST. I'd missed the lead into the story but caught the report in progress. The silver Mercedes-Benz recovered this evening from Brunswick Lake has been positively identified as the vehicle belonging to prominent local physician Dowan Purcell, missing since September 12th. Detective Paglia of the Santa Teresa Police Department would not confirm. Over her commentary, there was a series of clips. A shot of the hillside near the reservoir, a shot of Crystal arriving by car, a photograph insert of Dr. Purcell, followed by a shot of the family home in Horton Ravine. The anchor moved on to a story about a cat stuck in a length of pipe. 9.5 weeks of agony reduced to less than a minute. Folks would probably have more sympathy for the cat. There was a tap at my door. I figured it was Henry coming over to apologize. Instead, I found Tommy Heaveners standing on my porch.
Hey, where you been? I called you earlier, but your machine was on. I thought I'd see you at Rosie's.
Henry told me he saw you.
Yeah, we had a nice chat. He's a great old guy.
Look, I've had a hard day. Something's come up on a case I've been working.
You want to talk about it? I'm a good listener.
I don't think so. I appreciate the offer, but I'm bushed and I think I better go to bed.
I hear you. No problem. Call me tomorrow. I want to see you again.
Okay. I'll do that.
You take care.
Yeah, you too, I said. As soon as I closed the door, my heart began knocking rapidly in my throat. I threw the deadbolt home and leaned against the wall to wait until I heard his departing steps. Outside, a car started up and I listened as the sound of the engine diminished down the street. I don't know how I managed to get to sleep that night. I had no emotional attachment to Dow Purcell, but the sight of that body in the front seat of the car had left me unsettled. I'd seen death many times, but I couldn't seem to block the image of that four-wheeled silver coffin and its hoary contents. I replayed the moment, floodlights hissing in the rain, the sound of water gushing from the underbelly of the car, the smell of mud and crushed grass, followed by the quick flash of the body in its formless repose, eyes turned toward the window, mouth open with amazement. I didn't think it would take long to identify the body, half a day at best. It would take longer to examine the car and come up with a theory about how it had ended up in the lake. There was also the question of whether Purcell was dead or alive when he went into the water. Again, I flashed on that face, the wide grin, the sightless eyes. I made a conscious effort to divert my attention, fixing on the problem of Tommy and Richard Heaveners. Despite my obstinate and disputatious stance, I had seen Henry's point, which I knew was correct. I'm forever sticking my nose in where it doesn't belong, often with consequences more serious and potentially deadly, than I care to admit. I was under no obligation to assist Mariah Talbot or Guardian Casualty Insurance, so I put myself in the line of fire. The boys were not my problem. Mariah had even hinted she had an alternative if I decided not to help. I still had to find a way to break the lease and recover my deposit, but maybe Lonnie could write the brothers such a blistering letter they'd be begging to get me out. As for the murder of their parents, I had to believe the law would catch up with them eventually. As much as it grieved me to admit it, retribution wasn't mine. Oh, darn.
Chapter 17. Much of Wednesday I was occupied tidying up odds and ends. At 6 o'clock that morning, I'd managed to squeeze in a 3-mile jog between cloudbursts, after which I'd gone to the gym. I'd come home, cleaned up, eaten breakfast, and arrived at the office at 9:15. I spent the bulk of the day catching up on paperwork, including my personal bills, which I paid with the usual sense of triumph. I love keeping all the wolves at bay. Twice I sat down at the typewriter to frame my final report to Fiona, thinking I might as well go ahead and drop it in the mail to her. However, having delivered both a report and an invoice just the day before, I was a tiny bit short on bullshit and tiny bit short on cash. I thought it could be bad form to charge for the time I'd spent waiting for the cops to pull Dow out of the lake. Since I'd forked over her $1,500 to the infamous Heavener brothers, the $1,075 I owed her would have to come out of my checking account, which currently showed a balance of $422. I had plenty of money in savings, but I didn't much feel like dipping into it. Besides, I was still entertaining the fantasy that Fiona would write off the balance out of appreciation for the speed and efficiency with which I'd concluded her business. She'd hired me to find Dow, and I'd found him sooner than either one of us expected, though not in quite the condition one would have wished. I couldn't help but hope for a $1,075 pat on the back. Ha, 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 she thought. I considered calling Crystal to offer my condolences, but couldn't bring myself to do it. I wasn't a family friend, and I was afraid my motivation would be interpreted as ghoulish curiosity, which of course it was. Just after lunch, I went back to the file Mariah Talbot had left. I glanced at both wills, picking my way through sufficient legalese to confirm that the Atchison jewelry had been left to Brenda's sister, Karen. I then went back and reread the news clips. Hatchet, Texas, was located roughly 60 miles from Houston and had a population of 2,800 souls. There'd only been one other murder in the town's entire history, and that was back in 1906 when a woman took a piece of firewood to her husband's skull while he was sleeping. She'd killed him with 6 blows after he got drunk once too often, knocked her teeth out, blackened her eyes, and broke her nose. Satisfied he was dead, she tossed the log on the fire and brewed herself a pot of tea. The death of Jared and Brenda Heavener made headlines as far away as Amarillo, where Brenda had been born and raised. According to the paper, the bodies were discovered in the rubble the day after the fire. The blaze had been fierce and fast, fueled by accelerants, fanned by dry winds. The volunteer fire department was called at 1:06 a.m., arriving on the scene within 17 minutes. By then, the house was completely engulfed in flames, and their efforts were largely focused on preventing the fire spread to adjacent properties. Neighbors quickly realized the Heaveners were unaccounted for. At first, the fear was expressed that all 4 family members had been taken unawares and had perished in the conflagration. As it turned out, Tommy Heavener had been visiting friends in San Antonio. He managed to track down his brother Richard, who was traveling in the south of France. The initial newspaper accounts were filled with shock at the deaths and sympathy for the sons whose loss everyone assumed must be devastating. They were long biographical pieces about Brenda and Jared, her community service, his rise in the business world. The turnout for the funeral was impressive. Newspaper photos showed the cortege stretching out for blocks. Pictures of the cemetery show the 2 coffins surrounded by flowers, Richard with his head bowed, while Tommy stared bleakly at the gravesite with an expression of despair. Mariah hadn't been impressed with their acting skills, but I could see how easily their grief could have been interpreted as heartfelt. Within days, the time delay device and accelerants were identified and traced to Casey Stonehart, 23 years old and clearly not that bright, as he purchased the materials in a town only 16 miles away. With his troubled criminal history and his questionable IQ, it wasn't hard to conclude he was acting in concert with somebody else. He clearly wasn't smart enough to plan and execute the job by himself. Over the next 6 months, the tone of the story changed as public skepticism grew, and the ongoing investigation shifted to the possibility that the two sons had been involved. On their part, there were many outraged denials and vigorous protestations of their innocence. Law enforcement authorities and the fire marshal responded with a number of carefully worded statements, hoping to avoid a lawsuit if their suspicions turned out to be groundless. The story played for weeks and then died away. There were periodic updates, but most of the later coverage seemed to be an endless rehash of the original account. Casey Stonehart warranted very little in the way of column space beyond the occasional query as to his whereabouts. Reading between the lines, I could see the bureaucratic tensions begin to accumulate. The DA was accused of bungling, pressure was brought to bear, and he was forced to resign. Despite the launching of a second, even more extensive investigation, no new evidence came to light. Formal charges were filed against Casey Stonehart in absentia, but Richard and Tommy Heavener managed to evade official blame. A year later, two short clippings referred to the lawsuit they'd filed against Guardian Casualty, trying to collect various insurance benefits. 6 months after that, there was a brief mention of the close of probate and the settling of the estate. What a depressing chain of events. I shuffled through the articles again just to make sure I hadn't missed anything. The story made me restless. I could feel the masked avenger aspect of my personality girding her loins, prepared to seek justice and to right old wrongs. At the same time, Henry's accusations had hit perilously close to home. I'll admit I'm occasionally foolhardy and impetuous, impatient with the system, vexed by the necessity for playing by the rules. It's not that I don't applaud law and order, because I do. I'm simply indignant that the bad guys are accorded so many rights when their victims have so few. Pursuing scoundrels through the courts not only costs a fortune, but it offers no guarantee of legal remedy. Even assuming success, a hard-won conviction doesn't bring the dead back to life. In this matter, though I hated to be practical, I'd come around to Henry's point of view. I intended to mind my own business for once. I left the office just before 3 o'clock and walked over to the bank. Fortunately for me, the check I'd written to Heavener Properties hadn't yet cleared. Maybe he accumulated rent checks and made a deposit on a regular basis instead of one by one. I put a stop payment on it, returned to the office, and wrote Richard a brief, apologetic note, indicating that circumstances had changed and I wouldn't be renting space from him after all. Given my signature on the lease, he might well take me to small claims court. I didn't think he'd do it. Surely, in his position, he'd prefer to avoid legal wrangles. At 5:30, I locked up. On my way home, I drove by the main post office and dropped the letter in the outside box. I reached my apartment 12 minutes later, feeling lighter than I had all day. Before I unlocked my front door, I crossed the patio to Henry's place. I wanted to tell him I'd heeded his words. In declining involvement, I'd offer him full credit for motivating this rare evidence of common sense on my part. His kitchen light was on. I tapped on the glass, expecting to see him come into the kitchen from the hall. No sign of him. No sound of his piano. No hint of activity. I picked up the tantalizing scent of one of his oven-baked stews, so I didn't think he'd gone far. I returned to my apartment and let myself in. I turned on the desk lamp and set my shoulder bag on a kitchen stool. I gathered up the mail that had been pushed through the slot and was splayed out across the floor. All of it was junk, and I tossed it in the trash. The message light on the answering machine was blinking merrily. I pushed the play button. Tommy Heavener. "Hey, it's me. I've been thinking about you. Maybe I'll catch you later. Give me a call when you get in." I pressed erase, wishing I could do the same with him. I went into the kitchen. Saturday's can of tomato soup was the last I had, so I already knew there was nothing in the house to eat. Dutifully, I checked my cupboards and my refrigerator shelves. I've never actually seen a recipe that calls for 2 plastic packets of soy sauce, 1/2 cup of olive oil, Cheerios, anchovy paste, maple syrup, and 6 rubber carrots asprout with something that looks like hair. A clever home economist could have whipped up a nourishing dish out of just such ingredients, but I confess I was stumped. I picked up my bag again and headed out the door. Dinner at Rosie's. What a pleasant change of pace. The night air was misty and smelled of basements. It had been raining, off and on now, for 6 full days. The novelty had worn off, and those who rejoiced in its arrival were now cursing the rain's persistence. The ground was saturated and the creek beds ran high, a noisy rush of water pushing debris in its path. Unless we had a few dry days, the torrents would jump the banks and flood the low-lying areas. There were already county roads awash with mud and stones, covered with creeping sheets of water that made driving perilous. Given the ebb and flow of business at Rosie's, the bar area was teeming. The happy hour crowd would be gone by 7 p.m., as soon as the drink prices went up. The noise level had risen to a harsh, edgy pitch that seemed to reflect the mounting irritability levels. People were tired of raincoats, wet shoes, and mold spores that made their allergies flare up in a rush of sneezes and clogged sinuses. I left my umbrella propped against the wall by the front door, shed my slicker, and shook off some of the accumulated water before I hung it up. I made a useless display of wiping my feet, just to be polite. As I stepped through the inner door, I spotted Tommy Hevener sitting by himself at a table near the front. I felt a flash of irritation, feeling cornered. How was I going to get him out of my life? He was drinking a martini, the wide-rimmed glass at his lips, when he caught sight of me. I halted in my tracks, a split second of indecision, because the second person I saw was Mariah Talbot sitting in a booth at the rear. Adrenaline blew through my system like a hit of speed. Her telltale silver hair had been concealed beneath a dark, shag-cut wig, her blue eyes masked by glasses with plastic and rhinestone frames. The raincoat she wore made her body appear bulky. Unless you saw past the facade to the elegant bones of her face, she appeared frumpy and drab, not someone you'd notice in a crowd of this size. Tommy couldn't be expecting to see her, but he might make the same leap of recognition if he glanced in her direction. Looks as classic as hers are nearly impossible to hide. The minute Mariah and I made eye contact, she rose from the booth and slipped into the seat on the opposite side of the table with her back to us. I hoped the shock of discovery hadn't registered on my face, but I wasn't sure how I'd managed to hide my astonishment. My gaze flicked to Tommy's. His expression was quizzical, as though he'd sensed my surprise. He turned in his chair and scanned the rear of the bar. Abruptly, I crossed and sat down at his table. I touched his hand. "I'm sorry I was such a bitch last night." His gaze returned to mine, and he smiled. "Don't worry about it. The fault was mine." The mild Texas accent I'd found so attractive a day or two before now seemed to be an affectation. He was wearing a cashmere sweater, a soft, downy gray that played up his florid hair color and the green of his eyes. He was making intense eye contact and closing my hand in his. He lifted my fingers and placed a kiss in my right palm. I wanted to shiver, not from arousal, but from dread. What had once seemed seductive was only cheap display. He knew he was handsome, and he affected the shy country boy to enhance his appeal. I knew too much about him, and the force of his sexuality struck me as pure manipulation. In a quick recap, I realized that from the moment we'd met, he'd worked to dominate, beginning with my declining to drink a beer with him. He'd proposed a Diet Pepsi instead, popping it open before I could refuse. I'd taken the path of least resistance, and he'd established his control. After that, the transitions were smooth and well-rehearsed. He'd enlisted my sympathies by rolling out the reference to his parents' death, and then he'd offered up his comment about California women being so stuck up. Immediately, I'd worked to prove him wrong. His final move was adroit. "Which do you prefer? Guys way too young for you or guys way too old?" I couldn't believe I'd been so easily taken in. Peripherally, I saw Mariah leave the booth and head for the ladies' restroom. I rested my chin on my hand. Are you free for dinner? We could go back to Emile's or try somewhere else. Buy me a drink first, and we can talk about that. I pointed to his glass. What are you having? Vodka martini. He lifted his glass and tumbled the green olive onto his waiting tongue. I took his glass and got up. I'll be right back. As I moved by him, he reached out an arm to halt my passage. I stared down at his face, which he'd tilted up to mine. I could smell his aftershave. I could feel his hot, proprietary hand on my ass. I shifted out of his grasp and leaned closer, keeping my tone light. Don't be a bad boy. His voice was low and laced with confidence. I am a bad boy. I thought you liked that about me. I wouldn't count on it, I said. I crossed to the bar where William was at work pulling beers and mixing drinks. I ordered 2 vodka martinis and we exchanged inane remarks while I watched him pour a stream of vodka into a silver shaker and add a stingy dash of vermouth. William set 2 chilled martini glasses on the bar. Could you do me a favor? When you're done, will you take those over to that guy in the gray sweater? Tell him I'm in the loo and I'll be there in a second. He can go ahead if he wants. I'll have mine when I get back. Happy to be of help, William said. He put 2 doilies on a tray, set a martini on each, and came out from behind the bar. I proceeded to the ladies' room and pushed through the door. The room smelled of bleach and had only 1 stall. I knew from sad experience the wooden toilet seat was cracked and pinched when you sat. Mariah was standing at the basin making an adjustment to her wig. Aside from the sink, there was only a big plastic-lined waste bin and a grill-covered window that opened onto a narrow backyard. Up close, I could see that under the raincoat she'd pulled on a bulky knit sweater and a pair of flabby blue-print slacks with some form of waist-thickening padding underneath. The Birkenstocks and white socks were a nice touch. Very chic. She said, "What do you think?" "That disguise is lame. I've seen you once in my life and spotted you straight off the minute I walked in." She took a hair fork from her purse and lifted the top layers to increase the height. "Shit. This cost me a fortune, and it's not even real hair." "What are you doing here? Do you know how close you've come to blowing it?" "Tell me about it. Me and my big ideas," she said. "I tried to call, but all I got was your answering machine. I didn't want to leave a message. It's not cool. You never know who's going to be there when those things are played back. I didn't want to take the chance Tommy'd hear my voice. I figured it'd be easier to find you here. I walk in, thinking I'm safe, and there he sits. I nearly had heart failure." "You and me both. How'd he miss seeing you?" "Don't even ask. It was dumb luck, I guess. He was fussing with his raincoat, so I pretended to spot a friend and headed for a back booth. I sat there for 15 minutes, planning an exit through the kitchen. Then I happened to look up and saw you come in. What are the chances you can get him out of here?" "I'm doing what I can, but I don't like it. Last night he stopped by my apartment. I managed to avoid a visit, but he's persistent. I'm trying to turn him off, and now I have to turn around and suck up to him to cover for you." "Life's tough." She rearranged a few strands of artificial hair and then smiled to herself. "Here's a piece of good news. All their credit cards are maxed out. 6 to 8 cards each, 18% interest on the unpaid balance. They're making minimum payments just trying to keep afloat. Fancy watches, fancy cars. The mortgage is $15,000 a month on that monstrosity they call home. They've got their nuts in a vise and they're feeling the squeeze." "They're completely broke?" "They will be if they don't act fast." Her eyes met mine in the mirror. The combination of the wig and the outfit made her seem coarse. Not the cool professional she'd been in my office when she'd laid out her credentials. Maybe she was more of a chameleon than I'd given her credit for. "I don't suppose you've had time to tell Tommy about the fence." "I'm not going to do that. I really can't help you there. I'm sorry." "Don't sweat it." She tucked the hair fork away and then turned and leaned against the sink so she could study me. "I'll get the fuckers with or without your help." How'd this become so personal? Murders always personal. I take offense when I see guys like them getting off scot-free. Aside from that, Guardians promised me a big fat bonus if I can bring this one in. Behind the glasses, her eyes were a clear blue and very cold. She nodded at the door. You better get out there. Prince Charming awaits. I left the restroom and stepped into the blast of noise unleashed by all the alcohol. Smoke was adrift in the cavernous room. I felt as though I'd been gone an hour, but a glance at my watch showed less than 10 minutes had passed. I pushed my way through the crowd, returning to the table where Tommy waited. Henry had joined him, and he was sipping his usual glass of blackjack over ice. His elbows rested on the surface of a manila envelope, and I wondered if he was planning to do some work later on. I experienced a momentary surge of hope. His presence would at least spare me any intimacies. I sat down. Hi, Henry. I knocked on your door earlier, but I couldn't seem to rouse you. I was sounding way too perky, but I couldn't help myself. I popped over to the market. I needed some fresh parsley to finish off my stew. Henry's stews are legendary, I said in Tommy's direction, though I couldn't meet his eyes. I lifted the martini glass and took a sip, then steadied the wobbling glass as I set it down again. I licked at my hand where the vodka had slopped over the rim. Henry glanced over at me, and we exchanged a brief look. I knew what he was up to. He was feeling protective. He had no intention of letting me consort with the enemy unchaperoned. His gaze settled thoughtfully on his drink. He said, By the way, I looked into that business you were asking me about. I said, Ah, thinking, business? What business? The guy you want to try is Cyril Lambrow in the Klinger Building, off Spring Street in downtown Los Angeles. The woman I talked to sold him an assortment of her mother's antique jewelry. This was stuff she hardly ever wore, and she was tired of paying the exorbitant insurance premiums. I felt myself separating from my body. I couldn't believe he was doing it. I'd backed away from Mariah's scheme, and here he was, laying out the bait. Henry had launched himself on his maiden lie, which he'd offered in my behalf. I knew why he was doing it. If the jeweler's name came from him, how could I be blamed for it later when the deal went sour? Henry and Tommy had spent the previous evening together. Tommy would trust him. Everybody trusted Henry because he told the truth and he was straight as an arrow. I said, I can sympathize. I pay a fortune for insurance and I could use the cash. My voice sounded hollow. I moved my hand out from under Tommy's with the intention of lifting my glass for another sip of my martini, but I realized I was shaking too much to get the glass to my lips. I tucked my fingers under my thigh. I could feel how cold they were even through my jeans. Meanwhile, Henry went on as smoothly as a con artist with an easy mark. I called the fellow myself and described the diamond to him. He wouldn't make a commitment on the phone, but he seemed interested. I know you don't want to give the ring away, but you're going to have to be realistic. You'll never recoup the actual value, but he sounds a lot more generous than some. I think this would be for his personal collection, so it might be worth a shot. I tried to reconstruct from his comments the phony tale he must have had in mind. The implication was that I had my mother's pricey diamond ring and was in the market for some cash. Apparently, I'd consulted him about selling it, and he'd asked around. So far, so good, but the trick with a good lie is not to push. I thought we might go another round or two, but then we'd have to move on. String a lie out for too long, and it can trip you up. My mouth was dry. How much? I cleared my throat and tried it again. How much? Did he give you any idea? Between 8 and 10,000. He says it depends on the stone and whether he thinks there's any secondary market, but he swore he'd be fair. The ring's worth 5 times that, I said indignantly. I knew the ring was imaginary, but it still had sentimental value. Under the circumstance, 8 to 10,000 sounded like chicken shit to me. Henry shrugged. Check around if you want. There are other jewelers in the building, but as he says, better the devil you know. Maybe. We'll see about that. Tommy's expression hadn't changed.
He seemed to listen politely, no more and no less interested than any ordinary guy would be. I felt a trickle of sweat inch down my spine to the small of my back. I pointed and said, "What's in the envelope?"
"Oh, I'm glad you reminded me. I have a present for you."
He passed me the envelope, watching expectantly as I undid the clasp and folded back the flap. Inside, neatly secured with a paperclip, was a handful of bills, presumably Clotilda's. "Okay, I'll bite. What is this?"
"See for yourself. Go on and open one."
I slid off the paperclip and picked up the first bill, which appeared to be a lengthy, itemized list of charges, most of them for medical supplies. Brush hair, $1. Steri strips, 3M 1 quarter by 3, $1.22. Steri strips, 3M 1 quarter by 3, $1.22. Syringe monojet ins, 14 cents. Syringe monojet ins, 14 cents. Syringe monojet ins, 14 cents. Catheter all perp Davol, $1.59. Baby lotion, $1.62. Tray, barred irrigation, $2.69. Cups, denture, 14 cents. There were roughly 30 items in all. The total was $99.10. None of the charges seemed out of line to me. I glanced at the next statement, a record of therapeutic exercises and physical therapy sessions, totaling 130 minutes over the last few days of July. The box for each day bore the initials PG, the therapist who rendered the treatment. I looked at Henry with puzzlement. He said,
"The whole batch is hers. I came across them this morning and thought you'd be interested. Take another look."
I picked up the next invoice. This was a claim for portable X-ray equipment, the transport for the portable X-ray, and two X-ray exams, one of the wrist and one of the hand. The total was $108.50. I glanced at the top of the form and then shuffled back through the first two. All three were generated by Pacific Meadows. I didn't realize she'd been a patient at Pacific Meadows.
Neither did I. I showed them to Rosie, and she said Clotilda was admitted last spring. Pacific Meadows was one of several facilities where she'd been a patient in the last few years. I don't know if you ever paid much attention, but she'd be hospitalized for something, a fall, pneumonia, that staph infection she picked up. With Medicare, she was only allowed X number of days, I think 100 per illness. She was so cranky and disagreeable, a couple of places refused to take her. They just claimed there wasn't room. Are you following this?
So far.
Check the date services were rendered.
July and August. Henry leaned closer.
She passed away in April. She'd been gone for months by then.
For a moment, I let the information sink in. This was the first tangible evidence of financial shenanigans that I'd seen. But how had they managed it? Clotilda must have died at just about the same time the paper audit was being conducted at Pacific Meadows. According to Mary, a substantial number of charts had been ordered for review. Maybe hers wasn't one. I tried to recall the sequence of events whereby deaths were reported to Social Security. As nearly as I remembered, the mortuary filled out the death certificate and sent it to the local Office of Vital Statistics, which in turn forwarded the original to the county recorder's office. The death certificate was then sent to Sacramento, where it was archived, and the information went on to Social Security.
Henry, this is great. I wonder if there's any way to check it out.
I was, of course, pondering the notion of persuading Mary to do some snooping for me. I'd have to wait until the coming weekend, which was when she filled in. I didn't think it'd be politic to approach her during regular weekday hours with Mrs. Stegler standing by. Plan B was maybe doing a little search of my own if I could figure out what to look for. I glanced up to find both Tommy and Henry watching me. Sorry, I was trying to figure out what to do with this. Tommy must have decided he'd been polite long enough. His hand settled over mine. His grip was firm and prevented my pulling free without being conspicuous about it.
"Hey, Henry, I hate to butt in here, but this lady's promised to buy me dinner. We're just having a quick drink before we walk over to Emile's. Henry said,
Well, I better get back to my stew before it starts sticking to the pan.
He flicked a look at me as he rose to his feet. I knew he didn't want to leave me, but he didn't dare persist. At the prospect of his departure, I felt the same desperation I'd felt when I was 5 and my aunt walked me over for the first day of elementary school. I'd been fine while she lingered, chatting with the other parents, but the minute she left, I had a panic attack. Now I could feel the same roar of anxiety that dulled everything but my longing for her. Henry and Tommy exchanged chit-chat, and the next thing I knew, Henry was gone. I had to get out of there. I tried to withdraw my hand, but Tommy tightened his grip. I tapped the manila envelope.
You know what? I really need to look into these. I'll have to take a rain check on dinner. I hope you don't mind.
Tommy minded. I watched his smile fade.
You're reneging on a promise. Maybe tomorrow night. I've got work to do.
I knew it wasn't smart to go up against this man, but the notion of an evening alone with him was intolerable. Mariah had to be gone by now, and if not, that was her problem. He began to rub my fingers, the contact slightly rougher than was strictly necessary. The friction became uncomfortable, but he seemed unaware.
Why the sudden change of heart?
Please let go of my hand. He was staring at me.
Has someone told you something about me?
I could feel my jaw set. What's there to tell, Tommy? You have something to hide?
No, of course not, but people make things up.
Well, I don't. If I say I've got work to do, you can take my word for it. He gave my fingers a squeeze and then released my hand.
I guess I'd better let you go then. Why don't I call you tomorrow? Or better yet, you call me.
Right. We stood at the same time. I waited while Tommy shrugged into his raincoat, picked up his umbrella, and adjusted the clasp. When we reached the entrance, I retrieved my slicker and umbrella. Tommy held the door. I made short work of the fare-thee-wells, trying to control my desire to flee. I turned toward my apartment while he walked off in the opposite direction on his way to his car. I forced myself to stroll, though my impulse was to scurry, putting as much distance as possible between him and me. Chapter 18. I went back to my apartment and locked myself in. Tommy gave me the creeps. I went from window to window, closing the latches, pulling the shutters across the pane so that no one could look in. I didn't relax until every possible bolt and bar had been secured. I sat down at my desk and found Mariah Talbot's business card, which I'd tucked in my bag. I was nervous about my association with her. Tommy'd been uncanny in his suspicions about me. I pictured him rummaging in my purse the minute my back was turned, coming across her card. People like him, obsessed with control, need the constant reassurance that no small detail has eluded them. I committed the number to memory and cut the card into small pieces. I was uncomfortably aware that he still held my rental application, which spelled out more about me than I really wanted him to know. He'd never fully believe I was focused on matters related to Dow Purcell. In his mind, whatever I was up to must have something to do with him. Narcissism and paranoia are flip sides of the same distorted sense of self-importance. In the eerie way of all psychopaths, he'd picked up on my newly minted fear of him. He must be wondering who or what had caused my attitude to shift. I sat down at my desk and dialed Mariah's Texas area code and the number on the card. I knew I wouldn't reach her, but at least I could leave her a message to get in touch with me. I thought about how deftly Henry had stepped in with the name of the fence. He'd lied as well as I did, and with the same finesse. The question now was whether Tommy would act on the information. Mariah's answering machine clicked in. Hello, this is Mariah Talbot. You've reached the offices of Guardian Casualty Insurance in Houston, Texas. My usual work hours are 8:30 to 5:30, Monday through Friday. If you're calling at any other time, please leave a message giving me your name, the time, and a number where I can reach you. I check my machine frequently, and I'll get back to you as soon as possible. Thank you. I said, Hi, Mariah. It's Kinsey. We need to talk. Please call me at my office number. If I'm unavailable, leave me 10 seconds of silence. After that, just keep checking your messages. I'll call and suggest a time and a place to meet. Thanks. As I spoke, I found myself hunched over the phone, my hand cupping the mouthpiece. What did I imagine? Tommy Heavener pressed against the outside wall with a handheld listening device? Well, yeah, sort of. Talk about paranoid. Having placed the call to Mariah, I turned my attention to the bills Henry'd given me, sinking into the comfort and safety of the job before me. The first in the pile bore the heading Medicare Summary Notice, and further down the page, a line that read, "This is a summary of claims processed on 8/29/86. If I could lay my hands on her medical chart, I could find out what the doctors had been treating her for. I knew about some of her illnesses, but I wanted to see what medications and supplies had been ordered for her. I could then compare the actual orders to the items for which Medicare had been billed. Shuffling through, I found an explanation of medical benefits form, account statements with codes, boxes for co-pays and deductibles, invoices, plus several records of daily treatment, physical therapy by my guess. No diagnosis was ever mentioned, but in the first half of August, the charges for medication alone totaled $410.95. Hundreds of additional items, many of them minor, had been billed to Medicare in the months since her death. Of course, this could be an error, a mix-up in accounts with goods and services being charged inadvertently to the wrong patient billing number. On the other hand, Clotilda's surname, with its odd, impossible Hungarian spelling, appeared throughout. So this was hardly a matter of someone misidentifying a Smith or Jones, or switching one Johnson for another with the same first initial. Most helpful to me was the fact that while the claim number changed, Clotilda's Medicare number followed her from form to form. I made a note of the information on a scrap of paper, folded it, and slid it into my jeans pocket. I wondered whether her records were still available at Pacific Meadows. Almost had to be, I thought. She died in April, and I assumed the facility would keep her records in their active files for at least a year before retiring them to storage. I waited until 9:30, filling my time with various household chores. Cleaning out a toilet bowl can be wonderfully soothing when anxiety levels climb. I scrubbed the sink and the tub and then crawled around on my bathroom floor, using the same damp sponge to wipe down the tiles. I vacuumed, dusted, and started a load of laundry. From time to time, I looked at my watch, calculating the hour at which the residents of Pacific Meadows would be bedded down for the night. Finally, I exchanged my Sauconys for black tennis shoes and then slipped into a black windbreaker, which was better for night work than my gaudy yellow rain gear. I separated the house key and the VW key from the larger collection on my key ring, transferred my driver's license and some cash from my wallet to my jeans, and then added a small leather case that contained my key picks. This particular kit had been designed by a felonious friend who'd spent his spare moments in prison fashioning an assortment of picks that looked like a manicure set. In between breaking and entering gigs, I could nip my cuticles and file my nails. The only other item I took with me was a flat flashlight the size of a playing card that fit neatly in my bra. On my way to the nursing home, I made a detour by the drive-thru window at McDonald's, where I picked up a sack of burgers, 2 Cokes, and 2 large orders of French fries. When I arrived at Pacific Meadows, the parking lot was close to empty. The day personnel had departed, and the night shift operated with a considerably reduced staff. I parked my car in a darkened area, picked up the sack of fast food, and locked the door behind me. The rain had been held in abeyance, stalled over the mountain range just north of us. Meanwhile, we'd enjoyed a sufficient break between showers that the pavement was dry in patches. Crossing the tarmac, I reviewed the layout of the building, calculating the location of Ruby Kurtzinger's room. I knew a bird feeder hung outside her sliding door, and I was hoping I could use that as a reference point. I had just reached the corner of the building when a car turned into the lot behind me. In stealth mode, I stepped into the protective shadow of a juniper while the driver backed the vehicle into a slot midway down the row. The car was a classic, long and snub-nosed, fenders softly rounded,